So I think most people are present. At least they're here. So for today's talk, I'm going to be continuing on, just using that Eightfold Path, different renderings, translations, understandings, and now to bring it into the meditation aspect. Because when we talk about the seventh factor, mindfulness, all supported by what's gone before with the right view, with the letting go, with the kindness, with the gentleness and patience, and that informing our right efforts, we have the practice of the mindfulness. And you all know this is a core part of the meditation, and that awareness, can you maintain it? If you try force, it's like sometimes you get your mindfulness, say, right mindfulness, you're going to stay here. You're not going to wander off. You're going to be here for half an hour, and you're going to watch the breath, or you're going to watch this, or you're going to watch that. And using force like that doesn't work. And a simile, it's an old simile, I hope you remember it. And I often say that I usually like teaching old people, because even though that I told the story just a week ago, they can't remember it, and it's fresh again. But this particular story is the woman who got a call on her cell phone from a friend. And on that call, does sound okay? Was it resonating? Reverberating? It's okay? That one side, okay. Anyway, whatever. She received a phone call, and it was from an acquaintance. Are you free this afternoon? I said, yeah, being honest. Oh, great, can you come to this coffee shop? It's my favorite coffee shop, and it serves excellent latte. I know you don't like latte, but I like latte, so come and have a latte with me. And I'll come to the back, because I know you like sitting in the front, but I like going to the back, because I want to talk to you about politics, not about your silly religion business. This is real stuff, politics, it's important. And you're going to have a chocolate chip muffin, because I like that. I know you don't like that, but I like it, so you're going to eat the chocolate chip muffin, talk about politics, sit in the back, having a latte, and we'll be there for 1 hour, because I have to go to another appointment after 1 hour. Now, in this simile, you receive a phone call. Someone is telling you what to drink, what to eat, where to sit, for how long, and what to talk about. That's called a control freak. It's not a friend. And so you would try and escape with any possible means. But of course, you can't really lie, but you can sort of bend the truth a little bit by saying, oh, I just forgot, I have a dentist appointment this afternoon. And so maybe next time. And then after you hang up, you call your dentist to make an appointment. And after you call the dentist to make an appointment, you get another call, this from another friend. And this other friend said, oh, you keep telling me about this wonderful coffee shop which serves delicious cappuccinos. I don't usually have cappuccinos, but you know, usually, but anyway, you say they're so wonderful, so I thought I might try them. And you know, you say the biscuits are to die for. They're so wonderful, they're so delicious. And on biscuits, it reminds me, you know, on Thursday is Anzac Day. Yeah, so anyway, there was this Englishman, Irishman, and Scotsman, and Australian went into the pub. These weren't Buddhists, obviously. And the Englishman said, No need to pay for the drinks. I'll pay for the drinks today. My wife has just given birth to a son, my first child. And because, he said, it was St. George's Day, which is April the
21st?
3rd, I think, isn't it? So, so, yeah, tomorrow. Now you know the suffering of being a teacher. But anyway, so I decided to name him George because St. George's Day, patron saint of UK, of England. And the Scottish folks said, that's really weird. What a coincidence. Because my first son was born on St. Andrew's Day. So I called him Andrew. And I just went, wow. You know, it's amazing just how many coincidences happen. Because my first son was born on St. Patrick's Day. So we called him Patrick, Paddy. And the Australians said, wow, even though in Australia we don't have a patron saint, my first son was born on Anzac Day. So we called him Biscuit. Anyway, so, you know, sometimes I make up jokes. That's one of my originals. You should know that because it's not that good. And every now and again, somebody sends you a joke from the internet. And, oh, I invented that because some of these jokes must come from somewhere. And so, you know, with their origin. But anyway, back to the coffee shop simile. Stop encouraging me.
Sorry.
So I go to the coffee shop, and sort of afterwards, you know, after making an appointment with the dentist, this best friend says, please, you know, do you want to come for this cup of coffee, which you know, I don't really like, but you said it's really delicious, and eat what you like to eat, and sit where you like to eat. And you're always telling me about this meditation. I've never done meditation or Buddhism before, but I'm really interested. Can you come tell me something about it? So that's your friend who wants to drink what you want to drink, eat what you want to eat, sit where you want to sit, and talk about the things which interest you. What's your response? Say, okay, I'm cancelling my dentist appointment, I'll be there. And you spend all afternoon, not an hour, hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, enjoying each other's company, sitting with somebody who really is a friend, who wants to speak and talk with you about what interests you, not just what interests them, and to try what you like to eat and drink, and sit where you like to sit. And that's a simile between how to be aware of the breath, or aware of anything in your mind, and the mind never wanders off. Because many people say, right, be aware of the breath. And you're going to sit there for 1 hour. Okay, not 50 minutes, don't move. You can watch the breath for 1 hour, and you can do it my way, not the way you want to do it, but the way I want to do it. And of course, and not just sit in a cushion there, leaning against the back, you're going to sit properly on the ground. You know, full lotus, don't move. That's called a control freak. So do you recognize the control freak in your mind? So this is how we're supposed to meditate. So you say, I'm going to meditate. You're going to watch the breath this way. You're going to sit for this long. You're going to sit in that posture. You're going to do it this way, not for too short, not for too long. No wonder that your mind runs away and wanders off. Who likes to sit and be with a control freak? If you really are a friend, you're with your mind, and say, well, what do you want to do today, mind? Do you want to watch the breath? Or do you want to fall asleep? Or do you want to think about the meaning of the universe? Or do you want to plan about what's happening in the world? What do you want to do today, mind? And how long do you want to do it for? 5 minutes, an hour, whatever? And if you are kind to your mind like that, and you are going to work with your mind as a good friend, then what happens? Just like that lady in the coffee shop, you spend all afternoon there and time flies. And where did that go? I've been sitting meditating for 3 hours. How did that happen? Because you are a friend to your mind, not a control freak. So with mindfulness, you always have to have the kindness as well. The kindfulness is a form of respect for your mind. There are times when your mind is really tired. It's had enough of watching the breath. So what do you do? No. You haven't finished yet. You're not in jhana yet. You watch your breath. And of course it rebels. There's no way to treat the mind. So if you treat your mind with kindness, then, and I say you don't want to watch the breath today. Oh, that's fine. You watch something else if you like. What do you want to watch? If you're kind like that. Now this is one of those stories, key stories, about how to let go. When I was at that monastery where I was talking about Garudas the other day, and this particular monastery where I just really got to love the smell of bat poo, and also, what's the other one? That's bat poo monastery. In that same monastery, perfect by myself, no distractions, not outside anyway, but inside. I thought it was absolutely perfect. So I was meditating and meditating and meditating and meditating, and after a while, my mind started getting restless. Really restless. So, okay, let's go back to the breath. Put it back onto the breath, breathing, watching my breath, being mindful of the breath, and it would go off again. Come back, go off, come back, go off, come back. And then what happened? The restless thoughts got worse and worse and worse, more extreme. I started thinking, I was only 29, six rains as a monk, got my six rains retreat. And then I started thinking, well, you know, I'm still young. Maybe that girlfriend is still available. I said, stop it, no, I want to be a monk. But you know, she was really nice. No, stop it, Ajahn Brahm. And my mind started wandering off onto unmonkish thoughts. And they got worse and worse and worse, stronger and stronger and stronger, until I'd be ashamed to tell you all those things I was thinking about. And I couldn't stop it. Every time I tried to restrain and pull my mind in, it went off again. And so with no one else to talk to, I got very tired and frustrated and didn't know what to do, because this monastery, I was by myself. There was no sort of communications available. You'd only see a car, the traffic problem I called it, one time a week. A car would come up from down below to bring posts and supplies, and then it would go back again. You had to be looking at the right time in the right direction for about 5 minutes to see the car. That was the only traffic they had there. It was very remote and quiet and peaceful. But that was wonderful, except if your mind started to go crazy. And so I didn't know what to do. I went into the hall, and the only one to talk to there was a Buddha statue. I bowed and asked for help. How's the sound? Is the sound okay? Tinny, I'll put it down here. It's worse, is it? Is that better?
It's the same.
The same, okay. Anyway, I can hear it being tinny. What to do with me? Anyway, there you were, going a bit crazy. Can you hear it okay?
I'll put it aside. It is tinny. I don't know whether it's coming from there, or I'll pop out and see if Christina can do anything.
Okay, just go and, it must be tinny tuss. Okay, anyway, there we go. So now I was going a bit crazy. So I went into the hall, and I had this great insight. And my insight was to do a deal. Let's find a compromise, a middle way. And my middle way was, for most of the time, I'd behave. Watch my breathing. Meditate, be a good monk. But if my mind wanted to think of stupid thoughts, I'd let it think of whatever it wanted for 1 hour every afternoon from 3 till 4. That was my anything goes time. And so this is what I did. Sometimes I call it was my sexy time. Any thought goes. I didn't know what else to do. I was desperate. So for that hour, 3 to 4 p.m., I wouldn't try and control my thoughts at all. And what happened was still the same. Still had to just really work hard to try and keep my thoughts in control and just to be on the breath. It was such a struggle. But when it got to 3 p.m., when it got to that time, I went to my room. I said, right, you can think the most ridiculous, romantic, fantastical, or fantasy, weird, anything goes from 3 to 4 p.m. And this is what happened, which really sort of taught me so much about the nature of the mind. As soon as I said to my mind, okay, anything goes, you can think whatever you want, no control, my mind watched every breath without missing one so simply, so easily for the next hour. It was weird. And I wondered why. And it was because that when I was trying to control my mind was throwing a tantrum. So I don't want to be controlled. I want to be your friend. And so when I trusted my mind, then it behaved. And it stayed with my breath so easily. It taught me that if you do want to stay a long time and be stable, be still, be focused, have sustained attention, it's never achieved through force. It's only achieved through kindness and respect. So whenever I look at my mind, I respect it. I'm kind to it. I ask my mind, what do you want to do? Where do you want to go today? What do you want to be aware of? Do you want to do some walking meditation? Do you want to do some sitting meditation? Do you want to be aware of the body? Do you want to be aware of the breath? Do you want to do loving kindness? What do you want, breath? What do you want, sort of mind? And a lot of times when I respect my mind and care for it, it actually, it cooperates with me. So yeah, let's do some breath meditation. And so that I don't even need to choose to watch my breathing, it just comes to me. You just watch it, and it's there, easy. And we stay together for a long time because my meditation objects are my best friends. Is that okay, Christina?
It's improving. We're going to check it at 9 o'clock.
We're going to check it at 9 o'clock. Excellent. What happens between now and then? Anyway, so this is how we start to meditate. It's not just you force. It's through this great wisdom power. How do you manage to have mindfulness and sustain it for long enough for mindfulness to really do its job? And it's through like this wonderful kindness. So, with this mindfulness, that's why before you even start being mindful, we have to lessen these five hindrances. Wanting to be somewhere else, not wanting to be here, the restlessness, the tiredness. And this is the other place where we discovered some really powerful teachings about meditation. The restlessness and the sloth and torpor. And how people just oscillate between those two. And why is it that sometimes we're really tired and sleepy, and the next moment we can't even just watch the breath, we're all over the place. And it's not just the external physical conditions, which I was talking about, I think, yesterday. It's also just understanding the nature of the mind that people are tired and exhausted. And why are they tired and exhausted? It's because they struggle and strive far too hard just to get by in life. There's so many things you have to do and attend to. So people are tired. So what do you do when you're tired, when you have got low energy? Many people waste their energy trying to force their mind back into
its energized, clear state. That doesn't work. It came many years of just struggling with tiredness and sloth and torpor, and you realize that this is where that teaching of the two parts of the mind comes to the fore. The mindfulness, the knower and the doer. Those two parts of the mind. And if you just have enough reflection on the way that your mind works, we do way too much. When there's a problem, we struggle. When there's a difficulty, we put forth more effort to try and solve it. Whenever there's something, even something which we cannot solve, it's beyond our means, still we think, we plan, and it's amazing just how much energy we waste uselessly. No wonder we're tired. As the Buddha said, we're like an anthill, which people would use once the ants had disappeared, to make charcoal. You put the wood in there and it would be a flame during the day and it would smoke during the night time. I remember just being in the northeast of Thailand, watching the villagers make the charcoal, and I could relate to that simile very easy because I saw that many, many times. But here the Buddha used that as a simile for your brain. A flame during the day, doing this, going here, changing this, but during the night time it was smoking. In other words, thinking and planning and being anxious and just figuring out what went wrong. It's not physically working, but it's thinking and planning. It's like smoking. It's still work. It's still doing something. And he said, because of that doing, that's where we lose all our energy. And if we can stop or suppress or just restrain our doing, our reacting, to do less, even actually be still, then what happens? All that energy, which is wasted by running around, thinking, planning, and reacting, all that energy is now free to go into the knowing, into your mindfulness, into your awareness. Your mindfulness, awareness, literally gets empowered. You start to wake up. So many times, if I'm sleepy in the morning or in the afternoon, I've learned through practice never to fight it, to be kind to my dullness. And being kind to my dullness, there's some awareness there. I'm not totally unconscious, so I'm aware that I'm dull and sleepy, and I'm kind to it. The door of my heart is open to being sleepy. Come in. It's okay, mind. I can understand why you've been working too hard. So, when I'm kind to my sleepiness, when I don't react to it, I don't try and control it and fight it and do battle with my sleepiness, which is what most people think right effort and striving is all about, doing battles. Instead of doing that, I get to know and be kind. Even my mindfulness is not strong with my sleepiness, still I'm aware enough and kind enough to let the sleepiness be. But it doesn't stop there. Because when I just let it be, it's almost like a natural source of energy comes into your body and into your mind, probably just simple things just like your metabolism. And then that energy is not wasted doing things. It starts to flow into knowing. It's like putting the electricity just into the lights instead of the aircon. The lights get more and more strong, more powerful. Your mindfulness starts to increase. And it's not increasing because you do something. It gets stronger simply because you're not doing anything. You're charging the batteries and not wasting that electricity for something else, which is useless. So as the mind becomes charged up, it is like a misty morning. And when the sun comes up in the morning and it starts to warm the air, it starts to lift the mist, and the warmth of the sun eventually drives the mist away. And the air is clear and you can see so brilliantly, sometimes for long distances and sometimes very deeply and powerfully, simply because you haven't fought the sloth and torpor. You've let it be with kindness and you've waited until naturally the sloth and torpor vanish. And when I did that, when it did vanish, it didn't just go off into restlessness again and thinking and planning. It was just clear. And again, not doing anything, just watching, because the doer was wasting too much energy. Reacting, struggling, striving, trying to change things, trying to get somewhere. All that effort and energy, I realize, is better put into just awareness, just the knowing. And soon the knower, the awareness got stronger and stronger, brighter and brighter, and you could actually watch the breath, or whatever else you wanted to watch, easily. No effort, just there. And not just being aware of the breath, then your awareness, your mindfulness, not only just saw the breath and saw more of it, but it became clearer, more detail, colors enhanced, and even beautiful, delightful. It was a process which you discovered that related to exactly how the Buddha was teaching meditation in the texts. By letting go and being kind, the second factor of the Eightfold Path, and being patient, the mind woke up. The awareness became stronger. And you could see the breath very clearly. And it was delightful. And the simile comes up now. It's an old simile, but it's one of the most useful. The road on which this monastery and this retreat center is sited, Kingsbury Drive. It was 7 years I've been up and down that road in a car. And the first time, because people are just, sometimes you just say, I will give you a lift, Ajahn Brahm. And sometimes, oh, don't walk, you know, you might get attacked by a kangaroo or something stupid. It's not safe. So sometimes people won't let me do exercise and walk. I can look after myself. I remember just, it's great, you know, being outside the monastery. When I was staying with my mother and I was giving talks at the Sri Lankan temple in Chiswick, it was about an hour's walk, and I would insist, you know, I'm not telling the Sri Lankan temple when I was coming or when I was leaving, so I could actually do the walking. So I walked, but one of those days, when I walked, you know, from my mother's apartment or flat was in Acton, and I had to go through South Acton, which was really a rough area. There's lots of unemployed people in these council flats. And one evening, as I was walking, it was the time when the gang was assembling outside. These young hoodlums, young, tough, all together. I'm not sure if they were taking any drugs, but as I was walking on the pavement right towards them, they started chanting, Buddha, 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 Buddha. They weren't doing a mantra of meditating. They were trying to intimidate me. This was maybe about 25 years ago. And so as I got closer, I decided I'm not going to cross the street. I'm going to go right between them. And as I got closer, they also, maybe about 13 or 16 of them, some big gang, Buddha, 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 tried to make me scared. When I was about 5 meters before I would, you know, in front of them, I lifted my hands in my kung fu pose. I was really a stupid monk. But I got away with it again, because they didn't know. You know, in those days, you know, you've got a brown robe, bald head, you know, kung fu master, who knows? These days, I call myself Kung Fu Panda. Because that's my shape. But anyway, I've never done kung fu in my life. But, you know, when I was a kid, I used to watch this kung fu program. But anyway, I put my kung fu pose. You know, just bluffing all the way. And as I walked through, they parted and let me through. Another victory for the fake kung fu master. But anyway, that's why sometimes people, they don't want you to walk, you know, because something might happen to you. But things happen to me if I don't walk. But anyway, this time I insisted. I'm going to walk up the hill. So I got out of the car and started walking. Beautiful morning, just maybe like this morning, maybe a bit warmer. And I was walking up the hill, just taking my time, and just looking around me, and that was, wow, where am I? Because I couldn't recognize the hillside. It looked different, very different to what I remember seeing through the window of a car. And it was, you know, really so different, so shocking. 7 years up and down that hill, and I couldn't recognize where I was. The experience looking through the window of a car and actually walking is so different, it shocked me. So I stopped, stood perfectly still and just gazed at the hillside. Then it changed again. Deeper colours, more detail, more beauty. It actually looked incredibly wonderful. And I thought, why is this happening? Why, 7 years and I hadn't seen this before? And so, the answer was obvious. Once you have the experience, you can actually, it shows you what's happening. Imagine looking through the window of a car, which is traveling, you know, maybe 50, 60 kilometers an hour up the hill. When you're looking through the window of a car, light hits the back of your eye, the retina, image is formed, but it's not properly formed. Before another image hits the back of your eye and dislodges the first, and it has to attend to another image, and then another image, and another image. When you're going fast, the images come too quickly, so you can't really investigate and be and see the fullness of any one image. So when I just got out of the car and started walking, your sense of sight could pick up more detail and more colour. You know, instead of being washed out pastel, the greens, the yellows, the blacks, they were richer. But then, when I stopped and just perfectly still just watched, that's when all the detail emerged, every single blade of grass, and just the edges of the grass, and sometimes there was some dew from the morning still on there, and you could see it twinkling in the morning sunshine, and you can see the rocks and all the lichen on the rocks and the trees and all the different types of barks they had on it, and everything became so amazingly beautiful and detailed. And it was one of the first times you started seeing the greens more green than you'd seen before, simply because the colors had all the time in the world to fully form. They weren't washed out. Because, you know, the sight starts off with a chemical reaction on your retina, and then the mind has a chance to explore it. And to me, that became a very good symbol of what mindfulness is. When we go too fast, trying, forcing, traveling, then what we experience, we only experience a fraction of what's really out there in life, or what's even inside of us. But when we slow down, then we find that our senses can feel more. Even yesterday when I answered the question, it was not really an adequate answer, but it was done quickly, about eating meditation. Imagine you're going so slow, so peaceful, taking your time, you just put one morsel of food in your mouth, and you can fully taste it. One of the stories I was just finished an ice retreat. I think it was my last, no, not this, last year, the year before. I usually do a personal retreat once a year over in my cave. It's my holiday, my vacation. I don't go anywhere. I just go inside and just shut the door and the monks bring me food and I don't talk to anybody. But at this particular time, after the retreat was finished, when I went to the refectory, the dining hall in Bodhinyana Monastery for the breakfast, they made me some baked beans. Beans are very, very Buddhist food, because we often even chant it every day. May all beings be happy and well. Whatever beings they may be, especially baked beans. So anyway, I just had one bean, just one, a single baked bean, and I just put it in my mouth, and it was like a taste explosion. Just my whole mouth was swamped just with the incredible balance of the sweet and sour tomato sauce on the outside of the bean and the texture of the bean. Not too hard, not too soft. It was like melted in the mouth, but not just too soft. It had a texture, had fiber in it. And you could taste and feel the fiber and know just how that fiber is going to be so good for the health of your guts. Everything was just amazing. There was just one baked bean. And I was just blissing out on one bean. And it was crazy stuff, but truthful. Because this is what happens when your mind is so peaceful. Just one bean is incredible. And then you take the next bean. Oh, yeah, this is really good fun. Then you really enjoy your food. This was, I don't know if like Heinz has got like made by Michelin chefs 5-star, but that's what it tasted like. It wasn't actually obviously the food. It was my mind was so peaceful. You could pick up every flavor. And what you picked up was delicious, enhanced. Now, what's that got to do with something like meditating on the breath? And then when you finish your breakfast and you started watching your breath, the breath going in, whoa! You can feel just every moment of that breath when it first comes into your body, bringing with it coolness, and energy, and just health, the oxygen as well as the nitrogen, all these elements just coming into your body. And you can feel your body like sucking it, absorbing it in as the breath comes to its peak, full breathing in, and then it fades away as you sucked in and soaked in all this incredible air. And Australia, especially you get outside of the city, even here Serpentine, the air, the oxygen is so pure. Hardly any pollution at all. And I remember one of those times I went to India on pilgrimage and then finished off in Delhi. And it was so polluted there. And then we landed in Bangkok. And I thought, wow, Bangkok is so clean. And you're laughing there, it's not clean at all. But then, from Bangkok, we landed in Perth. And get out of Perth, and that's so clean. But it's not that clean. And then you come here, and now this is really clean. Beautiful, clean, pure air. And you breathe it in, you can feel its energy and its purity and its life-giving force coming into your body. Because your mindfulness is really strong. So, do you get bored with breathing? It's fascinating. It's incredible. It's joyful. You can watch it all day. Just breathing in. Oh, yeah. Breathing out. Oh, that was a good one. Another breathing in. Oh, yeah. This happens naturally, simply because as you're more and more aware, because of stillness, because of not doing things, your energies go into knowing. And just if a baked bean tastes delicious, a breath becomes fantastic. From the very beginning of an in-breath is a thousand, a million different sensations, and every breath I've ever breathed is unique. No two breaths are ever the same. You're crazy, Ajahn Brahm. What are you talking about? It's just breathing in, breathing out. If you're not mindful, if you haven't really got into this, yeah, maybe. But when you really get into it, your mindfulness takes off. And it becomes so interesting and so delightful. The joy starts to come up in meditation. And at this point, you mention good old Ajahn Gandha. Because when he first came here, he actually spent a range retreat in Bodhinyana many years ago. And we'd ask him to teach meditation. And his meditation instruction was very short, but really profound. All he'd ever say is, sit down, close your eyes, and breathe in, sabha. And breathe out, sabha. You know what sabha means? I mean, nice and easy, joyful, even sensuous. Just, sabha. Breathe in, sabha, breathe out, sabha. Can you do that? Breathe in, sabha. breathe out, sabha. What he was doing there, he was getting us to actually notice the joy of it and adding that flavour of happiness onto it. It's there, but you add it onto it, and, well, it becomes really a great meditation teaching. Now, sabhai means, I don't know what the other words you can use, like really cool, nice and easy, beautiful, joyful, delightful, all these other very positive words, and that's what you do. So imagine that you're doing that, breathing in, sabhai. Oh yeah, breathing out. Do you think your mind can wander off? Can't wander off at all. Someone says, hey, it's lunchtime. Oh, breathe in, sabhai. Oh, get away, I'm not going. You're having too good a time. It's a happiness. And if you look in the teachings of Satipatthana Sutta, and especially as it is explained in Anapanasati, the mindfulness of the breath. You start being aware of the breath, but you start being aware of the delightful breath. Breathing in, it happens naturally. You're breathing in there, just watching your breath. Okay, I just have to say these things because sometimes people learn this stuff. You're breathing in long, breathing out long, breathing in short, breathing out short. Which one you should do? Because sometimes when I learned that, sometimes my breath wasn't long, wasn't short. Maybe I was doing it wrong. It was in the middle somewhere. So then what do you do? Because it said you've got to breathe in long or you've got to breathe in short in Anapanasati. Mine was neither. And how long? And how short? It got very confusing. So in the breath meditation, Anapanasati, you know the instructions, breathe in long, breathe in short, breathe out short, whatever it is. How short? It never said. How long? How long is long? What if it's like two-thirds, neither long nor short, but a little bit on the long side? How am I going to measure it? Should I sort of, you know, get some instrument to see just whether, you know, what actually is my long breath and short breath, what's an average breath, and stop doing the average breath because it only said do long or do short. So of course, that's crazy stuff. You just breathe in and breathe out. You just sort of know whether it's longish or shortish, and then see the whole of the breath. And still, I'm really sort of sometimes, what's it called? Bamboozled. One of my favorite words, bamboozled. Bamboozled means just, you don't know where this comes from, why people keep on saying this. It is so, it's, right, to give you another word which is similar, which means you might be able to stand the word bamboozled, it means you're totally discombobulated, which is another of my favorite words. You don't need to know what it actually means, just what it sounds like. You know what's what it means. And that was just, when you're watching the breath, you've got to watch the whole of the breath. What happened there? Something fell off. Oh, that's the nature of things. Things fall off. It happens to me all the time, things fall off. It's just old age. Decay. Decrepitude. Anyway. So when it comes to just watching the whole of the breath, or that, they call it the whole body of the breath. That's literal meaning. Sabbakaya Patisangvedi. You experience the whole kaya. And the kaya can mean your physical body, but in this particular case, it's even said there by the Buddha, it counts, the whole breath is a part of the body. It counts as a body. You're watching the whole of the breath. Because otherwise, that third stage of Anapanasati, if you know your sort of Anapanasati Sutta, where it says to be aware of the whole body, what does that mean? It means when I'm meditating, I'm just watching the breath go in and go out, now I have to be aware of my toes, every one of them. So it's the whole of the body, no, not just part of it. I've got to be aware of my knees and my ear. It's crazy stuff. What it means, and it's a natural process, is your mindfulness starts to grow and enjoy its objects. You see, the whole of the breath is that just begins its journey into your body. It's not where you watch the breath, it doesn't matter where you're watching the breath. So many different feelings until the in-breath finishes. And then there's a pause, the gap between the in-breath and the out-breath. And this is just a skillful means. It doesn't really need to be done, but why don't you see if you can find the answer to this problem? Which people pay attention when there's problems to be solved. It's all part of the ego, because you know, if you get it right, you think, yes. But anyway, which is longer? The space between the in-breath and the out-breath, or the gap between the out-breath and the in-breath? Which pause is longest? Are you interested in finding out? Well, it doesn't really make any difference. It's just my skillful means of paying more attention to the breath. So you start to watch the breath and you start to see from the beginning to the end. And the end to the beginning. Fascinating. And little by little, you find it's interesting. And from interest, it becomes joyful. And from joyful, it becomes delightful. And you see, all of the breath is wonderful. Sitting here, just watching your breath, sabai, sabai. And it literally is pleasurable. And it's supposed to be pleasurable. It's a delight which sustains the attention, not the willpower. The willpower, after a while, is very unpleasant. You have to. It's like having this prison guard standing over you, like this sadist. If you move, you're in trouble. So it's natural. You just stay there because you're enjoying it to the max. And this was great to be able to have teachers like Ajahn Chah understanding that and just teaching that. You just, the joy in meditation comes up naturally because you're not pushing, you're not forcing. The willpower is not there. It's wisdom power. In this moment, just watching your breath come in, go out, slowly, just naturally, not doing anything, the awareness goes into the knower and it becomes bright, and what you see is delightful. Now, when you go to that stage of mindfulness, the kindfulness with the joy, then the nice things happen. Then you start to have the breath getting so joyful, you're not doing anything at all, so the breath starts to get so refined. It gets refined because you're not doing anything. You don't need so much petrol in your engine. Hardly anything is being metabolized. You're really still. And that is joyful. I had to learn that just out of self-preservation in those first years in Thailand because of the mosquitoes. These were the days, 1974, I think January 75 maybe, when I first went up to Ajahn Chah's monastery. There was no mosquito repellent, no mosquito coils, no mosquito netting. And for some reason, I was going to say sadistic, but this was my teacher, so I can't say that. He made us sit meditation for 2 hours from 6 to 8 under the trees in the forest, in the jungle, which, as you should all should know, was mosquito feeding time. That's the time they come out. And of course, they came out to feast on the monks. We had bald head, no protection up there. We had the bare shoulders, no sleeves. And the mosquitoes in Thailand, they had no monks. If they saw a bald head and a brown robe, it was like a safe meal. Because we weren't allowed to swat them. We were monks. We were compassionate. And as you know, that sometimes when you're compassionate, people take advantage of you. And those mosquitoes certainly took advantage of us. They knew it was a... And they really would take advantage. Sometimes, you know, you'd have your eyes open and they'd bite you. I said, come on, it's only a little bit of blood and I'm compassionate. You know, just have a nice meal. May this mosquito be happy and well. And you know what you'd do? Actually, I think she was she's, weren't they, mosquitoes? Anyway, what she would do, and I can't be gender specific in these days, but they put an exploratory drill hole down. For some reason, they didn't like that, and they'd walk over and take another one. Those mosquitoes were so fussy. I'm just saying, you're really lucky that you don't get swatted. So don't push your luck, mosquito. And so you get about 3 or 4 holes before they were satisfied with what they wanted. So they took advantage of you. But when you had hundreds of you on you at one time, which we did in those monasteries, it was really irritating. Not just one. I think we got up to about, with another monk, we played a little game. See how many we could count at the same time. We got up to about 60 or 70. After that, they were so too close together, you couldn't sort of distinguish them. But you could hear the slurp as they were taking the blood. That was an exaggeration. But about 60 or something like that was the record at the same time. What could you do? Sometimes you'd open your eyes and Ajahn Chah was there. If he wasn't there, I'd have run away. If he was there, you feel really embarrassed. So, okay, close your eyes. So the only thing you could do is just go into your breath. Breathing in, breathing out. And it soon became really calm and peaceful. You go inside because the outside was just too irritating. You go inside and you're just watching your breath. I had some wonderful meditations, thanks to those mosquitoes. I couldn't wander off anywhere because I just go to the irritating skin. Watch your breath go right inside, and it's really joyful. And I was really surprised, because when you sort of go inside, and just have a nice meditation, just watching your breath, it's so peaceful, so joyful, so refined. Then, you look at your skin, there was no bumps from the mosquito bites, no little welts. You get these little welts, especially Westerners, it all works when a mosquito bites you. Nothing there at all. So, wow, they haven't bit me at all. The power of samadhi gives you like a force field. So snakes and mosquitoes, they can't penetrate you. You know, just like one of these superheroes. What they call the those superheroes, Batman and the Ant-Man. This was Mosquito Man. Mosquito Man. They couldn't penetrate. Only afterwards I found out, no, it's nothing to do with anything psychic or anything supernatural. It's just because you're very calm and peaceful. You're not exuding any carbon dioxide. Your metabolism gone way down. And so it's what the mosquitoes recognize is the carbon dioxide coming out of your pores of your skin. The more carbon dioxide you emit, the more you're telling the mosquitoes where you are. So when you're really still and hardly metabolizing, you didn't exist. Mosquitoes couldn't find you. They didn't know you were there. That was the reason why. So it's fantastic. You get these nice side effects. Totally scientific, nothing psychic. But anyway, just the joy of being able to sit there for hours and just enjoy the breath, and even deeper. This is where your mindfulness starts to take off. And you can always see in the suttas the piti sukha which comes up, the joy and bliss which comes up, even just watching the breath. That is the, the fifth, sixth and seventh stage of the Anapanasati Sutta. And just for those of you who know this, it's you're breathing in, breathing out, experiencing the joy, the piti, breathing in and out, experiencing the sukha, breathing in and out, experiencing the mental formation, the citta sankhara. And you may not realize, but there's a lot of information with that description. This is the mind, this is how the mind looks at the breath. It's not as the body feels the breath, as the mind looks at it. It's the same way that the joy, the bliss, the taste sensation was not inherent in that baked bean, which I talked about. It was what was added by my mind onto that baked bean. It was the mind was feeling everything because it was empowered by stillness. The way that that hillside looked so beautiful was because the mind was still, the mind added the beauty. And so, what happens is that where does beauty lie? Where does the joy lie? It's not in the thing itself. It's not in your breath. It's not even in the food. It's the way the mind looks at the food. Citta sankhara. You experience the joy and the bliss of just watching one breath, breathing in sabhai, breathing out sabhai. That only happens when you learn how to relax, how to be still, how not to do things, how to be patient, how to be kind. That is where the energy gets taken away from the doer. The struggler, the wriggler, the writher, and when that gets taken away from the doer, the active part of the mind, and starts flowing into the knower, you wake up, and it's joyful, and it's happy. And meditation is the easiest thing in the whole world. Just sitting there, just breathing in, breathing out, what could be more difficult? Your boss gives you all sorts of tasks to do at work. You have to write essays at school, you have to write reports, you have to present, you have to answer emails, you have to brush your teeth, you have to do so much stuff. But here, breathing in, breathing out, the only thing you have to do in the whole world is just be breathing in, breathing out. What could be simpler? So the simplicity calms you down and the joy starts to arise, and then you find the mind becomes awake and blissed. And to finish off, the word for being awake all these lovely translations which people ask me to retranslate. The word Bhujati is a Pali word. It means to wake up. And what is the past possible? One who has woken up? Buddha. The awakened one. Enlightened one, it doesn't really capture the way that is achieved, or the way that happens, rather. You wake up, your mindfulness increases and increases and increases and increases. You see more, you feel more. You go outside and feel the cool air. Every part of your skin sort of tingles with the wind or the cool air. The birds start to make their noises in the morning. You can feel, hear every part of it. Someone farts and you can hear every part. There we go, I did one. And it's beautiful. It's just like in an orchestra, the birds are just like the strings and the wind instruments. Oh, sometimes it can be gross, but it's good fun. So everything gets really beautiful and lovely. And that's where the joy comes in the meditation. That's what makes meditation retreats just wow. You can really sort of, and it's not just for the sake of bliss. The next episode in the Eightfold Path will be the jhanas. Coming tomorrow. But right now, bliss. Breathing in, breathing out. That's mindfulness. Not through effort, through letting go, through kindness, gentleness, and patience. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.
Okay, very good. I don't know if that got recorded well, but you seem to be paying attention, so that's good enough. Crash.
I should always mention at this maybe time of the retreat, anyone who wishes to meditate in the hall at Bodhinyana, it's only a little ways away and it's worth the walk, because many people who can't get any peace in their room or here, that place over the road has got real strong power. So people who haven't had good meditation before, they go and sit up there and it's whoa, really good power. And even this, when I was away somewhere, one of the disciples, they brought their Feng Shui master to come and check out our meditation hall at Bodhinyana Monastery. And the report was, wow! The front of that hall has got incredibly strong Feng Shui. The back, not so much, but the front, oh yeah. So try it out. Sometimes it works. Very strong Feng Shui. Okay, so have a nice morning. And I will be interviewing people whenever I get there.